Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. I'm your host, Tom Schult, from the University of British Columbia. As Paul Whitfield Horn, Professor of Literature and Science at Texas Tech University, Bruce Clark has spent the last decade plus publishing groundbreaking scholarship introducing the application of second-order systems theory to the analysis of literature and media more broadly. The staggering scope of Clark's multidisciplinary erudition is on full display in the monograph Neo-Cybernetics and Narrative, out from University of Minnesota Press in 2014. In picking up Nicholas Luhmann's neologism Neo-Cybernetics in place of a more standard second-order cybernetic label, Clark carves out a theoretical continuum for his thinking that runs along a trajectory from Heinz von Förster's notions of the observer through George Spencer Brown's laws of form, Maturana and Varela's Biology of Cognition, and right up to and including Nicholas Luhmann's controversial extension of autopoiesis theory to metabiotic social systems, a theoretical move most often excluded from more orthodox second-order cybernetic thinking. The formidable theoretical apparatus he has assembled allows Clark to frame the reader of literary texts as an observer of semantic structures facilitating the psychic construction of possible worlds of meaning, and to examine literary texts themselves as forms of communicative action that continue the autopoiesis of meaning-constituted social systems along the lines of Luhmann's tripartite process of information, utterance, and understanding. From this launchpad, Clark takes us on a stratospheric ride with stops on a variety of fascinating landscapes, including the media theory of Friedrich Kittler, the socio-technical explorations of Bruno Latour, and encounters with artistic works as diverse as Virginia Woolf's iconic modernist novel Mrs. Dalloway and James Cameron's quasi-Gaian special effects blockbuster motion picture Avatar. As a result, Clark has given arts and humanities scholars an entirely new set of tools with which to think about artistic production, reception, and mediation. And so now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Bruce Clark. Bruce Clark, it is such a pleasure to have you here on the podcast. Thanks so much for making time to join us.
My pleasure.
So, can we start in our traditional way, just asking you to tell us a little bit about your intellectual biography or any part of your biography that you think is something you wish to share with us? I know it's a particularly colorful one, but I'll leave it up to you to decide what to leave in and what to exclude.
Well, I'll start with graduate school, where I went to study English literature, very much of a traditional sort. Ended up studying Romanticism and Modernism. Was contemplating a dissertation on William Wordsworth and D.H. Lawrence, and eventually, Lawrence decided he was going to run the dissertation. So but there's some oddities about Lawrence that had some germs of my future development. He had, because of marrying the redoubtable Frieda von Richthofen, he got exposed to Romantic science through her intellectual networks. And so that was kind of a beginning of how I got into, laid down some seeds for literature and science. So eventually I won't go into the gory details, but I wasn't really happening as a modernist, as a young professor. And I heard about this meeting of the Society for Literature Science, and I was a kind of amateur reader of popular science. And I went to this meeting. I met Catherine Hales. I ended up on a panel with Kate Hales, who's one of the major people in this new specialization for decades now. And everything just started to click for me. So I began by kind of as a student and fan of Kate Hales' work. And her own work came along to a certain take on cybernetics and systems in when she took up the topic of the post-human. So I kind of spun off of her work at the turn of this millennium, led me back to von Förster by some, also the work of William Paulsen took up von Förster explicitly. And so between the two of them, I began to discover this cybernetic background to chaos theory and complexity theory. And then a major milestone for me was going to the theory camp, the School for Criticism and Theory at Cornell. So that was the summer of 2000. I took a seminar with David Welbery, and it was Bateson and Spencer Brown and Niklas Luhmann's Social Systems major text of that moment. And I just took the deep dive at that point because everything started falling together. I was fortunate enough to have a lead on being in touch with von Förster. I went out to visit him at his home in Pescadero about a year before he died, put on a recorder and took an interview from him, which I created a transcript that was later published in the volume I did with Mark Hansen called Emergence and Embodiment. And that's the lead item in that volume. So I guess, and then the other kind of from the literary side, it was actually Hales who was already thinking about narrative from the side of chaos theory. And so I just began reading narratology and finding and around the same time I started reading Laws of Form, and although of course I had no idea if I understood it at all, but I could kind of take its diagrams. That's sort of the deep background of this book called Neo-Cybernetics and Narrative, is the way that I found to use the kind of diagrammatics of observation that you get from Laws of Form as a way of thinking about narrative attitudes, which is to say the location of the narrative observer as either inside the form, which would be the story world, or outside the form, which would be the position of the third person, or what I use the term the authorial narrator. So that was a kind of formalistic project that was driven from form theory and observation theory, as I was then learning that from the line between what I call Neo-cybernetics, just to touch on that, is Luhmann's neologism for the line of second-order cybernetics that leads to his social systems theory. So that's kind of how that term finds itself in there. And so what you have in that line from von Förster through Maturana and Varela, through the theory of autopoiesis, as they relate that to a discourse of cognition, as Luhmann then appropriates autopoiesis and extends it beyond the biological instance to psychic and social systems, but all within a kind of general theory of observation and form. So that's what really got me excited in the previous decade. And then to just to kind of finish that story up, I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship at IKKM at the Bauhaus University Weimar, which is a research project in media theory and philosophy. And so I did a lot of the writing for Neo-Cybernetics and Narrative in 2010-11 as I had that wonderful free time to think and bounce my ideas off the people in Weimar. There you go.
That's a whirlwind tour.
Yes, definitely.
And it's the reading list you gave yourself was obviously a monumental one, and it reminds me of my own sort of once you have your sort of conversion moment into the field of second order systems theory and cybernetics, you start grabbing all those titles and sort of grappling with them, sometimes in isolation and sometimes with some others you can talk to. But my own experiences of reading Laws of Form are racing back to me as you describe your own experience with that. So a couple of questions just following up on what you've just told us. What is it, because you mentioned that Catherine Hales has also talked about narrative, but you are fairly unique as someone bringing this type of thinking into a world of literary analysis and textual analysis and so much more, because the work is just so interdisciplinary. What attracted you to it in the sense of what was missing for you from other ways of approaching narrative or approaching textual analysis that this suddenly you went, oh my God, this is the thing that we're missing.
Well,
this is going to fill a gap.
I don't think it presented itself to me in quite that way. I mean, my sense of my own trajectory is that it's just been a series of serendipitous connections. And in a way, I mean, out here at Texas Tech, which people might not know is not a technological college, but a sort of full-blown regional university. But on the other hand, we're not an Ivy League university. But for me, it worked out really well because although I was hired to teach Romanticism, way back in the day, I got tenure kind of working my traditional canonical specialization, but very soon after getting tenure, the literature and science thing began to fall into place, and I just really had freedom to go where my interests led me. And so they just kind of led me right on out of my standard preparation. But one topic that I brought out of that earlier interest is sort of embodied in my first book, which is called Allegories of Writing, and it's the subject of metamorphosis. And gradually what I kind of cobbled together was centered on the topic of allegory. So this is a perfectly traditional, classical, literary topos, right? But allegory, as it turns out, is this kind of systematization of the meaning structures of a text, right? There's a sort of pervasive subtext. And so, of course, systems theory is something else again, but it has a theory of meaning in Luhmann's development, specifically coming out of Husserl and tying to the sort of horizon of the indication of meaning inside right. the form and that sort of thing. It wasn't that I felt that there was something lacking that I needed to fill up. It was just this sort of unfolding of new ways of pushing the kinds of thinking that I was doing into further formations. And it just kind of started right. to roll along. but then once you're in cybernetics and systems theory, you realize this is a meta theory of just about anything. I mean, or if you take it as a basic epistemology, which I do, mm-hmm. then you're good to go anywhere you want to take it.
Yeah, that's great. That's very well said. So your use of the term neo-cybernetics as opposed to second-order cybernetics, what I'm picking up is that word is specifically, and one of the things it's maybe doing is to make sure that it specifically includes the extension of autopoiesis to social systems via Luhmann in the way that some second-order cyberneticians to this day still don't quite buy. So that the term neo-cybernetics is, rather than second-order cybernetics, is saying this is part of the package that you're dealing with here. Is this extension of autopoiesis to social systems? Is that true?
Yes, that's exactly right. I this volume that I mentioned called Emergence and Embodiment. The subtitle is New Essays in Second Order Systems Theory, and I remember some conversations with Soren Breer, who was sort of wondering if he sort of questioned that usage when I proposed it, I guess, in some conversation we had. And I basically explained that, well, it's because I want to carry the conversation to Luhmann, but I want to bring it precisely out of the nexus of von Förster, Matron, and Varela, realizing that Matron and Varela themselves were leery to some extent of what Luhmann did with their baby, their concept of autopoiesis. You know, I talked to von Förster about that very thing when I interviewed him, because I'd already gathered that there was a kind of divide between the sort of the Varelans and Matron as well was he had his own way of getting beyond the biological instance, but it wasn't. But I just thought Luhmann had worked out the way to make that conceptual shift operate at a literal level by the redefinition of the elements of the autopoietic right. process, right? So as meaning events, basically, as opposed to some molecular chemical, biochemical, metabolic process. So it's in his text that he just kind of, I mean, without any particular fanfare, he just he drops the term neo-cybernetics in as the name he puts on what he's doing. So yeah. For me, it's just a shorter, it's sort of a less, it's a simpler way to say second order systems theory, which for me is the line that begins with von Foerster's theories of the observer and then goes directly to autopoiesis as cognition and then extends to autopoiesis as operating at what I call the metabiotic level to get it beyond the biological instance of cellular autopoiesis, which of course is a perfectly important part of the theory as well. But once you get it into meaning systems, then you're good to go for the textual literary application and you can then think about narrative as, and not as a system, which I think I try to make clear, a narrative in and of itself is not a system. It's a highly complex structure toward which a system must be brought, the observing system that constituted by the reader's consciousness of the text. That's how you get the system into it. But at the same time, of course, as a representational, as a semantic structure, you're moving back and forth between structure and system all the yeah. time. So narrative yeah. and systems then is narrative remains sort of, this is the sort of the infrastructure of structure upon which then systemic interest operates in its observational capacity to make some sense of what's going on with the structure. So that's kind Terrific. Of how it, yeah. how it fits.
That's
together.
Fantastic. And your inclusion of Luhmann is essential. And the angle that I pursue my own work is, and why your work is just so compelling to me is trying to use some of the same mechanisms in terms of theater and film, which is the domain that I come at this from. And the inclusion of Luhmann is kind of essential for doing that. So I think it's really helpful that you've created a sort of another sort of set of brackets around neo-cybernetics for those who do want to bring Luhmann along. And I've actually had a few emails from folks since this podcast began saying, is this a place where we're finally going to get to talk about Luhmann? Because no one wants to talk about Luhmann. So this one's for those folks who
fine with me.
Yeah. So this is great. So this takes us nicely into neo-cybernetics and narrative. So can you just say just a brief overview, because I know it's incredibly dense and wide-ranging. At the same time, some of the key elements of neo-cybernetics that that then we will bring to a study of narrative that you think are the key ones. You mentioned some things about the observer. There's also a notion of cognition, which is different than some traditional ideas about cognition. So those are two things. Sorry, are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, sorry. I'll have to edit that out. I just did something weird with my computer. I'll have to take that out. Okay, here we go again. So can you just give us a little overview of some of the key components and conceptual framework of neo-cybernetics that is important to your project of looking at narrative?
Well, I start with the sign. I start at the semiotic level, which grounds which essentially grounds the project in the structural moment, right, of the scholarship of narrative coming through the 20th century. I coined this term called semiolepsis, which I don't know that it's taken off like a rocket, but it has to do with the idea that where I want to make this basic distinction, of course, the sign does not observe itself. And sometimes when you read semiotics and you don't have a discourse that's kind of conceptualized, the observer in relation to the object, you know, it's you kind of get a sense that signs read themselves. And I want to say, well, not exactly. I mean, or that's a metaphor you can ply, but once so the observer has to be an originary moment of motivation for making the sign do something. But once you get those two, you bring those two together in this kind of originary act of reading as observation, the sign now leaps into the state of denotation or meaning production. And I was struck by a kind of allegory of signification in which that if we think about the kind of the movement of signs in the realm of meaning, it's like metempsychosis, which you'll recall means the transmigration of the soul from one body to another. And if you just go back into Western literature, and if you go back especially into the literature, the classical literature of metamorphosis, this is one basic event structure. That a metamorphosis is kind of the movement of the soul from one body to another. That could happen like in either in the life of a, like in the Golden Ass, which is one of my touchstone texts from classical literature, Lucius is transformed into an ass and then back into a human. Or if we just think of, but then when you get Ovid finally bringing in the figure of Pythagoras in the midst of the metamorphoses, then you have this kind of Pythagorean idea of the sort of continuous metamorphosis as the transposition or the leaping of the soul from one vehicle, right, from one signifier to another, you might say. So that's the kind of in this work specifically, I worked these ideas out as because in fact that was the annual theme at IKKM the year I was there was signs and things. So I had this impetus to just kind of work on this semiotic level of interest, which then, but at the same time to frame it in terms of the sort of the exterior of the structure, which is the dynamism that the observer brings to the situation of making meaning from sign structures. So to me, I mean, I consider that's sort of like a neo-cybernetic observation of the line from semiotics to narrative. Beyond that, to me, then I kind of move out. I touch on information, communication. So I've got kind of, I'd say, readings and critiques of information. So what was kind of crucial for me was seeing the way that von Förster himself develops from an information theorist, which, of course, all cyberneticists were information theorists at the get-go, because the two...
Shannon-Weaver variety.
As the two theories developed side by side to the point that they seem to merge together and many folks think it's the same thing, but in fact it's two separate bodies of theory. And what gradually what von Förster gradually works out is the limitation of information as a comprehensive concept. So information is kind of like the sign sitting there with no observer.
Yeah, he famously said, von Förster famously said there was no information in a library.
Or he just said, if I can remember the exact line, he says, the environment contains no information. The environment is as it is.
It is as it is.
But wait, the environment's supposed to be full of information down to its atomic structure. And it's, well, that's because you observe it in the mode of information and you make the distinctions that then around which informatic formations crystallize, you could say. But it's just not sitting there waiting for you to process it. You constitute it and then you process it. So that's a constructivist way of getting at it. So to me, neo-cybernetics, then you could also say, is about moving beyond the informatic orientation of, generally speaking, first order cybernetics. Communication.
Right.
Oh, go ahead.
Can you say a little bit?
I was just going to, I was thinking of my second chapter, which then takes up information and communication and treats these topics from the neo-cybernetic point of view.
Please go ahead.
The main thing is, it's pretty much strictly Luhmannian or just an application of the social systems theory as centered directly on the autopoiesis of communication. But communication theory itself sometimes lingers in that informatic complexion and so you get transmission models. So if you're in the informatic complexion of thought, then communication is transmission. In other words, it's pre-constituted and you just put it in the transmitters. It goes to the receivers. It gets decoded in some kind of automatic way. And so you get this sort of, it's already ontologized. That's what Luhmann would say. I mean, and that's the problem, that information is taken as constituting an ontology before anyone decodes it. It's constituted the apparatus itself is part of the infrastructure, but nevertheless the emergence of meaning bound up in these processes of selection, which Luhmann is laid out, in great detail, and as this tripartite series of selections, of which information, right, is one of the right information, utterance, and understanding. That's the Luhmannian triad of communication. So information's there, but it's just the first piece of the process.
And it's not information until selected, indicated by the observer. Yeah. Yeah. Can you say something about the trace? Because that's a really important notion in the book. And also, there seems to be a point at which the trace becomes the sign.
Sure.
You give this example of a scratch on a rock, and it could have been done as an act of agency of a sentient creature, scratching a rock and making a mark, or it could have been, a shard flying off from an asteroid collision, but it leaves a trace. And then at some point, the trace is going to become a sign.
Sure. So well, that a was a kind of, what I was thinking about was Calvino. Calvino has these wonderful stories in a collection called Cosmicomics. And he has one of these stories is called A Sign in Space. And it's other readers of Calvino have noted the resonances with Spencer Brown's Mark of Distinction. So And then you've got Derrida. So the idea that Trace is Derridian, or at least for me, in bringing that idea forward, that comes out of Derrida's discourse of the sort of originary Marx that can be aligned with Spencer Brown, but I don't know that that's many people have noted that. But so it's like the idea of an originary structure that may either be the product of an act of volition or a meaning event or an offer. Okay. In other words, if the scratch on the rock was just this happenstance remnant of a shard of an asteroid running across a piece of granite, you can still, it's still the trace becomes a sign of that inhuman or just kind of cosmological event. Go ahead.
And both versions you just mentioned to our stories words, too, right?
So I think it's been a while since I've read my own book, but the idea is that narrative is already there, kind of folded up in the scratch on the rock, in the trace, even whether it's a happenstance, cosmological, random event, or whether some sentient being decided, this is some prehistoric graffiti where I was here. Here's my scratch, and then it's just left as a remnant of an intention to signify presence of or whatever it might be. But you could tell the story at a certain point. It doesn't matter which story you've got, whether just the random cosmological event or the volitional intention to mean, the trace becomes a sign as soon as it's observed as a sign. And then a story inevitably starts to unfold from that moment.
So now when we turn to literary texts, should we think of a literary text as a sort of structure of traces that are then become signs in the act of the observation performed by the reader? Do they exist as traces first, is that the wrong question?
My discussion of the trace began as this kind of it was a kind of I thought of it as sort of playful effort to create a mythos around the sign. So the mythos of the sign would go back to this pre-semiotic moment of the trace, where something happens and a moment of inscription occurs. Okay. I think that mythos is something one could use to think about these, to take the contemplation of these things back to these originary moments. But just to open up a novel or a dramatic work or some narrative artifact in the medium of words, you don't necessarily need to contemplate the trace. You could just start with the semiotic register and start with the text and its discourse and for me, if we're talking about a prose narrative, then the narrator, you're going to have a narrator, and the narrator is an observer function, is an observer function rendered in the semiotic medium of the words of the text, right? And so you examine how observation is constituted and then unfolded across the. And so that works. I've been teaching these classes this semester where where this is just the basic lesson, and it's not even systems theoretical. This is narratological, the discourse story distinction, right? It's basically the distinction between the signifier and the signified coming out of semiotics as applied to the narrative text. So you've got a narrative signifier, and that's the discourse. And then the narrative signified is the story. So you've got the manner of the telling, and then you've got the tale told. And so there's your basic, and just getting sophomores and juniors to grok that basic analytical distinction takes me half a semester sometimes. I mean, some of them get it and go, wow, you know, and for others, it's right. Why should I just want to, you know, it kind of, generally speaking, people just want the story. Give me the story, you know. And I say, no. Back it up. You don't have to go back to the trace, but let's at least take it back to the mode of the discourse. So the discourse will constitute an observer. And this is pretty explicit in narrative, in prose narrative, right? Because the narrator then delegates focalization to a character who may also narrate, who may then tell what they observe, or your authorial narrator outside the story world gazes in to constitute the story world, to dive into the minds of the characters that are moving across it. So this is all kind of applied observation theory. And then it's actually in my previous book. I don't know if you looked at Posthuman Metamorphosis, Narrative and Systems. So in that text, I use the Spencer Brown formalism to work through the basic narrative attitudes, which are the observational attitudes, the kinds of the way the narrator as observer can be positioned relative to the story world under observation. So that's where I kind of diagram these narrative instances explicitly. And then in Neo-Cybernetics and Narrative, by the time I write that, I come back to Spencer Brown. But by then, I've had this wonderful graduate student who was a refugee from an engineer. He was an engineer, and he had the math background to really understand Spencer Brown. So I got him to teach me how to read Spencer Brown, like, you know, in a deep dive.
Oh, fabulous.
I'm afraid he's out.
Can you send him to UBC now that you're done with him? Can you send him up to Canada for me?
I think he's at a community college outside of Washington, D.C. now, last I heard. And but that was the difference. So in Neo-Cybernetics and Narrative, when I got back to Spencer Brown, I really knew how to tackle Chapter 11, the fearful Chapter 11 where self-reference enters the form. It's not really.
Right.
It's too complicated.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that right now?
Not really.
Okay. Let's turn to... we'll save it for another time. Let's talk a bit about some of the actual texts that you engage with through a neo-cybernetic lens. So one of the ones that I get most excited about is Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway.
Sure.
So can you say a bit about what drew you to that as a particular work to examine as a kind of case study in this book, and what viewing it from a neo-cybernetic perspective can open up for us?
Well, I really only do a kind of quick down and dirty treatment of its opening passage. Sometimes I'm a scholar of 20th century British literature. I don't really do my scholarship there anymore, but I was teaching grad classes on the modernist novel. So I'd been working on that. I'd been teaching that novel. So as I was developing in the same period that I was working out these narrative applications of systems theory. So it just struck me that, and so what you've got there is this really dynamic, immediate introduction of free indirect discourse, okay? Also known as figural narration in Stanzel's. So this German narrative theorist named Stanzel, whose work I like very much, it's kind of proto-systematic. But more generally, but if you get your narratology from Gerard Genette, it'll just be called free indirect discourse. So this is a narrative situation where you've got an authorial narrator, an external narrator, who's basically orchestrating the movement of observation between the narrator's level outside the story world and the minds of the characters inside the story world. So I just found that opening passage of the novel is so immediately rich in the not just that these devices of these kinds of and they're not, I mean, these devices aren't modernistic. I mean, they'd been seen, but they kind of get to a sort of reach a threshold of intensity in the modernist novel, you could say. So I look at how the way that novel opens is kind of a primer in, if you attend to it carefully, to kind of mark you can kind of mark the passage with, you know, kind of in a Spencer Brownian sense of eliciting the thresholds where these kind of boundaries of indication are crossed one way or the other, moving back and forth between the exterior of the story world and the interior of the story world. But then I leave it at that and move on to something else. But you can certainly then, and what we would do in my class then is just then proceed on through the novel and study it for its mobilization of this sort of intensification of writerly operations of that really exercise the range of narrative possibilities to the extent that we get, right? So we get novels sort of observing themselves. So we're moving towards what is called postmodernism, where the self-reflexive arc of these devices becomes explicit, or we reach this further threshold where narrative self-reference becomes a device in itself.
One of the reasons I wanted to mention Mrs. Dalloway in the first place is because in addition to rereading your book, I've been re-listening to an audiobook version of Mrs. Dalloway, which is an even more or a different kind of extraordinary experience than simply reading it, because in terms of this kind of semiolepsis that's going on and jumping between various observers, the power of Virginia Woolf's ability to literally make us feel as if we're in the head of another observer, the distinctions drawn, not just about what is currently being observed, but the characters' reflections of the past. You've got them all thinking about their time at Burton, and Peter Walsh is thinking about India. And So what's happening for us as an observer, a second order observer in those moments? Is there a sort of neo-cybernetic way to talk about what makes Wolf such an exemplar of a particular type of narratology?
The particular level of dynamism with which she shifts, that you become attuned to this kind of rapid fire. You're trained to be on your toes to as you just brought out, not just the shifting, the variable focalization that we would call it in straight narrative terminology, as we go into one mind and then out of that mind into another mind that might just be there in the same room at the same moment, but all of the analepses, right, which the technical term for flashbacks, then, and that I'm reminded that's also happening right there in the opening passages, that not only does Mrs. Dalloway come to the door and throw the doors open and gather in the morning, but immediately her interior life, her thoughts go back to this previous moment of a kind of similar breaking into the rising day, and so I think the only thing, what I would call neo-cybernetic in the manner of this kind of attention to the narrative, is sort of that, how you can kind of refine that process of narrative observation with the through a sense of how Spencer Brown's form theory works, right? So that you have these thresholds, you have you can mark the moments of crossing, right? And each cross, right, which is one of your basic when you're working with the form, that's one of the primary operations, right? Is crossing the line of indication, or crossing the boundaries that define one space or one meaning or another. And so I think that's pretty much what I'd say, is that you have this additional methodology that you can bring to kind of systematize the kind of narrative of your observation of the narrative. Mm.
And the crossing.
So there's a self.
Go ahead.
Right. I mean, and there's, and since we're in second order thinking, the sort of the self-referentiality, the recursiveness of these processes is kind of foregrounded by that methodological sort of situation or conceptual framing that you're working through.
Mm. And Wolf, as the author, never gives us an authorial voice that says this is a world outside of the constructivist framework. That all we get are these crossings from one organizationally closed consciousness to another. There is no access to the freestanding, quote unquote, real world outside of the mediated descriptions of each of the characters, in a sense. So, and yet one of the...
Yes, that...
Sorry, go ahead.
I agree with that. And so that's distinctive to her discretion in... So that her authorial narrator is consistently covert and everything is figural, right? So we really remain deeply embedded in the story where we're not brought out to a comprehensive observation. For instance, I was just teaching Brave New World. It's not really my favorite novel, but there you've got this overt narrator who's also takes you into the minds of characters, but then steps out to ridicule them just consistently, because, of course, the Brave New World is so screwed up And we're not allowed to forget that this is a dystopian nightmare that we've been brought into. But Wolf doesn't, I mean, in a way, that's kind of the lesser art of Aldous Huxley right at that point. Although it's cool enough in its own right. But Wolf's, you know, her kind of supreme artistry is that what we think of as that modernist kind of covertness. The author doesn't divulge themselves.
And the author then does not take up the position of a kind of privileged observer who has the last word on how, what right. it's really right. like, right?
Right.
You know,
right. Creates a narrator that doesn't divulge itself.
Yeah.
In working that out.
And at the same time, one can't help but thinking as you make these leaps to the consciousness, various consciousnesses of the characters, that they seem so real, they seem so vivid, and I certainly get the sense that I've known these people. And of course, the second order systems theory, you're in this place where any kind of access to some kind of mind independent truth is not on the table, and yet she seems to create something that for the reader one experiences as true. And so that takes me to the idea of the eigenform. Is she just particularly adept at generating a set of eigenforms? And for listeners who are not familiar with that term, this idea of fixed points of meaning that are generated in the case of humans through neurophysiological means, but that what we agree on as the real world is this shared set of eigenforms. And again, we need another hour to unpack that at least. But because that to me is one of the great paradoxes of Wolf, is that, and especially looking at it from a neo-cybernetic perspective, is like, okay, I'm not committed to a mind-independent ontology yet. Damn it, this just feels like she's telling the truth. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a way of getting at her consummate greatness as a novelist. But more generally, that's why we read novels, because they allow, and to the extent of a writer who could just work this illusion of revelation of other minds, we get out of the what otherwise epistemologically we have to accept, I think, as the closure, right? The actual real life closure of the autopoietic system, which in this case would be my mind or your mind. Thank God we have this thing called communication. by which we mutually reconstruct what we take the other person to mean, as, for instance, we're doing right now in this conversation. But when you read a book like Mrs. Dalloway, I mean, that's why it's just really so, that's the mark of its greatness, because even though we shift rapidly from mind to mind, as we get the feel for this world and the feel for these people, we just slip right into them. And so the bonus of pleasure we get from that experience is partly because it's completely impossible, unless telepathy is real, which it isn't. As near as my experience would, so that's of course another topic I take up in neo-cybernetics and narrative, because it's so interesting that, but in the medium of prose fiction, telepathy is absolutely, you just have to snap your fingers and kind of nuance the device. You transfer the conventional capability of an authorial narrator to go into the mind of a character, and you just put that ability into the mind of a character, and you've got a telepathic character. man, I just finished teaching Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon. Mm-hmm. Do you know this novel?
I know of it, but no, I haven't read it. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody knows of it, right. But few people have read it.
Kind of like Laws
and
of
I just and it's sort of it takes it's just absolutely full of telepathy. You've probably read Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. Maybe not, but a long time back, right? But where you've got so science fiction often sort of in its fantastical mode will just bring telepathy. I mean, that's kind of the signifier of futurity or higher mental evolution or some such thing, is that all of a sudden we're telepathic and the closure of consciousness, you know, falls away, and that brings its own set of problems, which is thereby hangs many a tale. But here in what we think of the depiction of the realistic world, or the world that does not transgress the closures in reality, narrative, the pleasure of narrative is that it simulates that experience that we can't have.
Right. And fulfills a desire. Yeah. For that kind of.
Right. It fulfills.
So as a writer, I mean, I'm asking you to just speculate wildly here and sort of just riffing on these themes, but I find this conversation so stimulating. That is a great writer like Woolf, because then one goes, well, what separates Virginia Woolf? It seems like an almost quasi telepathic ability to imagine what it must be like to be inside other minds, because those other minds seem to make so much sense to us as what an other mind might be like. And in a sense, she could only do that by being an astute observer of other people in a kind of black box sort of method, right? It's like I watch people, I see what stimulus they are, you know, I see what goes in and I see what comes out in terms of their behavior, and I construct an inner world, and then a third party reads that explanation of that inner world and goes, that seems plausible. I mean, it all just shouldn't be possible in this world of organizational closure, and yet it takes place.
It takes place in the story world. Sure. I don't have the formula for that genius. But we can sure appreciate the aesthetic experience that it brings us. The eigenform. I mean, maybe I haven't tried this, but there might, if you took a kind of micro analysis to her prose, you might be able to trace the eigenforms that, I mean, which would be these, I think these kind of recursive, some kind of recursive process that's instantiated in the semiotics of the discourse that coalesce, right, to the, that stabilize the sense of the livingness, right, or the inner reality of the personhood that's being constituted by the text of this novel. I don't know. Yes. Well, you asked me to be wildly speculative. I mean, maybe one could actually discern those patterns. I never took it that kind of microscopically down in.
Maybe Pask's conversation theory and creating entailment meshes for the characters and revealing them as what he would call the P individual, the psychological individual, the constellation of ideas, concepts that form a kind of coherent whole that is the psychological individual. But yeah, the project for a really ambitious grad student.
There you go.
Yeah.
There's a dissertation in the making.
That's right. Sure. Let's just turn quickly, and we're almost at the end of our time. You've been very generous with your time, but I want to ask about another, steering wildly away from Virginia Woolf, to the James Cameron film Avatar. And I know you, much of your scholarship in recent years and going back a while, you've been interested in Gaia theory, And obviously there's all kinds of metempsychosis going on in Avatar and other things. So what drew you to looking at that film and how it contributes to the larger project of the book?
Right. Well, when I came to the IKKM in fall of 2010, I immediately had to give a lecture. I ended up being the kickoff lecture of their fall series, and so I had this lecture gig, and I needed something cool to do. And I think I briefly tell the story in the chapter where I was flying to a conference in Riga, Latvia, mm-hmm. on a Russian airliner from JFK, and Avatar came on the screen, and I hadn't seen it before, and so I watched Avatar in this little tiny backseat screen on an airliner, but I immediately it just as you say, it's technologized metempsychosis. It's about this apparatus, this system, right? This technological system, which is the Avatar system, and the guy gets in the link booth, and then his mind shoots into this drone organism, and the Avatar comes to life in the world of the. Of the Metakaya. And so my mind just started spinning around because I saw, I just thought I could really sink my teeth into the infrastructure of the story world, right? Not just sort of the story of the characters, but then all of the paradoxes, the two-sided form, right? Mm-hmm. That is the Avatar mind. And so I just, the two-sided form being this kind of Spencer Brownian concept of being inside and outside the form at the same time. And so the main character kind of tumbles into being inside and outside the story world at the same time. And and so I bought a DVD, and then I just started studying the movie like on the screen and came up with this. So that at that level, it was kind of it's a cybernetic science fiction, you know, inside and out. It just mm-hmm. not necessarily second order, but it's really more first order cybernetics. But still, you've got these transmission apparatuses, but what's being sent is not messages, but consciousnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So
and a controlling consciousness, yeah, right? They need to control these avatars. They're
exactly.
steering them, literally. Yeah.
Right. You get so it's control theory, and then you get all the political, colonial, references or resonances of the colonial exploiters coming into the native indigenous world and so forth. And that's kind of the level of the more standard discussion of the movie. It takes up those cowboys and Indians tropes. But so I my dive was to go into it at the level of what's actually being imagined if we think that there it could possibly be the case that such a system, right, could be constructed, when in fact what's happening could only happen in a story. In other words, that same metempsychosis of that narrative can produce is being now you've just got this kind of technological infrastructure for that. Now the Gaia connection comes out of Bruno Latour, because he wrote about that movie a couple years prior to and And Latour was already kind of meditating on Lovelock and Gaia theory. And you have this planetary element, but you have this kind of, it's more the sense of the indigenous peoples as having this connectedness to their home planet, right? That we've lost as being these rapacious modern humans who just tromp over the world instead of feeling a connection with it. Of course, it takes that down into the fact that these beings have neural connectors. Like, wouldn't that be great if we could do this interview just by putting our neural connectors together? So they just plug into their world. That's not really Gaia theory. That's a part of the problem with actual Gaia theory is actually discovering that we've got a planet that's in fact systemically, at least that's the theory, is that the planet, the what we now call the Earth system, out of the Earth system emerges these feedback loops that actually have regulative effects over, for instance, just the level of oxygen in the atmosphere maintained at within certain thresholds, that's not just a happenstance deal. I mean, so you know, the actual Gaia discourse isn't. I mean, what I think of is the true Gaia discourse, which is the scientific hypothetical writings of James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, doesn't trip out, beyond operational closures. But of course, in the movie Avatar, well, just like narrative, generally speaking, it's going to find a way to transgress operational closures because that's what narrative does. And so they all, like, at some point they can plug into each other, or they plug into, or they, when they ride those winged creatures, right, they make the bond. You must make the bond. and they plug into each other, and then the mind of the indigenous humanoid is now controlling the mind of its winged vehicle and so forth and so on. So it's all great fun. And I personally responded powerfully, although I have to confess I've never seen the movie in 3D. which experience is awaiting me. But in a way that's kind of bells and whistles that are above and beyond the kind of interest in thinking about narrative and systems. So that's kind of, I saw Avatar and I went, my God, it's narrative and systems. It's my deal. So I'm going to.
Right in the wheelhouse. And it also points to this longed for telepathy that seems to be sponsoring a lot of narrative activity in general, is some that desire, that longing, even on a fantastical level, to break through the operational closure, on a planetary level, interpersonal level, as in Mrs. Dalloway and all the rest. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, and the book covers even more ground than this. You talk about some other stuff from both popular culture. You talk about Memento, and you talk about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So some more films for the film lovers out there. And then you talk about Latour's Aramis, a truly unique piece of writing. So there's so much in this book, and it's just such a rich read and just opens up so many new avenues for us to think about in a cross-disciplinary way in terms of narrative and systems and the planet and all kinds of things. So we're all immensely grateful for the fertile mind of its author and looking forward to what comes next. So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a book on Gaia. it's not really, so this is not, a literary study or even a study. It's a study of Gaia discourse, mainly. So it's a deep dive into Lovelock and Margulis, and their most worthy expositors, like Bruno Latour, Isabel Stengers, Donna Haraway, Dorian Sagan, and then the scientific and cultural context. So the scientific context is NASA, which people don't necessarily realize how that Lovelock conceived Gaia while working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory as a NASA contractor, and a lot of the funding in the initial decades for both he and Margulis was NASA funding. But then you've got the Whole Earth Catalog. You've got those crazy hippies who rediscover ecology and the fact that we're living on a bounded planet, spaceship Earth, and we're getting the first images of the whole Earth seen from space. And these people had their cybernetic antennae all the way up, thinking about whole systems. Very fascinating connections between Stuart Brand, the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog, and Heinz von Förster, the amazing review of laws of form that Heinz contributes to the Whole Earth Catalog, and then morphs into Coevolution Quarterly in the mid-70s, and they published the first popular article on the Gaia hypothesis in 1975. So it's kind of about, you've got a mainstream Gaia history that is not that well known. You've got a countercultural Gaia history, but it's not the one where Gaia just kind of wanders off into answering cultural desires as a kind of return of a Mother Earth. That's part of the story, but that's not really the story I want to tell. I want to tell the cybernetic appreciation for what was in fact a cybernetic theory. Lovelock conceived Gaia as a biological cybernetic system that homeostats the planet to maintain habitable conditions, and that's the. That's the initial form of the hypothesis. And so there's this interaction between the mainstream and the counterculture that is very rich and very, and it's one of the great stories of cybernetic sort of production, sort of the, that Gaia is the product of cybernetic thinking. I don't think people appreciate that background. And so that's what this study is about.
I can think of no better author to tell that story than Bruce Clark. So we look forward to that very much. And thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time.
My pleasure.
Listeners, get a hold of this book, because it's going to open up whole new avenues of thinking for you. So thank you very much, Bruce. And we hope to talk to you sometime in the not so distant future.
Thanks, Tom. Sounds good. I really appreciate it.